This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network. My name is Jeanette Cockcroft, and I'm one of the hosts on this channel. Today, we're going to be talking with Eve Golden, who is the author of Strictly Dynamite, The Sensational Life of Lupe Velez. So please welcome Eve to the program.
Hello, darling. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're more than welcome. This is such an exciting book. Let's jump right into it. Who is Lupe Velez?
She was one of the most talented and remarkable women in films in the 1930s and 40s. She never became a major star, which I think is a huge injustice, because she could have been another Garbo or Dietrich, as far as I'm concerned. And unfortunately, she didn't have a major studio backing her. So despite her amazing talent and gorgeous looks, she descended to B films and wound up committing suicide, and is best known, unfortunately, for Kenneth Anger's false claim that she drowned in her toilet.
Oh, there are so many places to go with that. So where is she from?
And she's from San Luis Potosi, Mexico, and spent much of her childhood in Mexico City. She became a revue star in her mid-teens, really, very young, and wound up in Hollywood in 1927 and became an almost instant star in the late silent era.
And what do you mean by a revue star, in case we have listeners who don't know what that is?
Sure. Musical comedy reviews. She did imitations of famous Mexican stars. She played the ukulele, she danced, she sang, she kidded with the audience. You can see there's a clip in one of her films, The Half-Naked Truth from 1932, where she gets up on stage and just cuts loose and has a wonderful time singing and dancing and interacting with the audience. And you can see from that clip how she first became a star on stage. And she had huge success on stage for her entire life, both on Broadway and in vaudeville.
So what do you think happened? Because I know in the book you talk about the fact that she could have been, as you say, on par with Garbo. Why did that not happen for her?
There were a lot of things working against Lupe. She had a heavy accent, but so did Garbo and Dietrich and Maurice Chevalier. I think there was a certain amount of racism there because she had the wrong accent. Being Mexican was not as acceptable as being Swedish or German or French, and she was looked on as a person of color. So that did not help her. She also was unable to alight at a studio who would give her a long-term contract and support her which is very important. She should have been Oscar nominated for Resurrection in 1931, but she didn't have a studio backing her. So being a major freelancer did not help her at all. And also, her personality was a bit much. She was always dialed up to 10. And I think that despite the fact that she was very professional and never made trouble on set, always knew her lines, worked late, I think her vivid, shall we say, personality sometimes worked against her as well, both personally and professionally.
Strictly Dynamite, huh?
Really was. You know, it's embarrassing, the whole title Mexican Spitfire, which she did 8 Mexican Spitfire films later in her career. It's really embarrassing, but she really was a Mexican Spitfire. She was kind of a living stereotype.
Let's talk a little bit about those movies, Mexican Spitfire series. Where did that come from in terms of the concept and in terms of its place in her career?
Well, she made a film in 1939 called The Girl from Mexico, and it was such a big, low-budget B-hit that it was decided that she would star in a series, which were very popular at that time. Before television, there were a lot of B-movie series. I mean, Blondie and the Bowery Boys and a lot of detective films. And they saw this as a great vehicle for Lupi. And it was, although really watching all of them, I'd say only 2 of them were really enjoyable films. The rest of them were kind of paint by numbers and repeating the plot over and over again and replacing the actor who played her husband 3 times. So it was good income for Lupi, and it got her out in front of the audience, but it killed her as an actress. I mean, you can see in a couple of the movies, she's just walking through them, which was unusual for her. So she was really anxious to get out and do some real acting again.
There are several places in the book where you talk about the fact that some of the movies that she was in were quite unremarkable, but that the critics were absolutely taken with her. So can you talk about that a little bit? How did she end up in such unremarkable movies? And what was so extraordinary about her in those unremarkable movies?
Well, a lot of stars wound up in unremarkable movies. Garbo and Dietrich and Harlow and Crawford, they all were given a number of real stinkers because you had to take the stinkers in order to be rewarded with a good film. So it's not unusual that Lupi made a lot of bad films, and there are some really good, enjoyable ones scattered throughout. But the fact that she was, by 1935-36, a B-star meant that she got the films that weren't as well-written, well-produced. They were shot very quickly, so they made money, and they were a great income for Lupi. But again, they did not stretch her talent or show her off to her best effect. However, as you said, she wowed the critics and the audiences. They loved her because she had such forceful personality. She very rarely walked through a film. I mean, maybe 1 or 2 films she did that. Usually she was giving it her all. She could sing, she could dance, she could do comedy, drama, and she loved performing. She loved her audiences. And that really comes through in the films, even the bad ones.
Let's talk about some of the good ones and the noteworthy ones, starting with The Gaucho, with her first one.
It's remarkable that she was 17 or 18 when she did this, and it was her first major film. She did a couple of shorts earlier on, and she steals the film from Douglas Fairbanks. She's really remarkable as the wild mountain girl who falls in love with Fairbanks. She has both comedy and dramatic bits in there. It was a major high-budget release, and she just aces it. It's incredible that someone that young with so little experience was able to give such a nuanced and professional performance. And it's a silly film. I mean, it's I love Doug Fairbanks and I love Lupi, and It's very picturesque and well shot, and the plot is absolutely ridiculous.
That sounds like a nice Saturday afternoon experience.
Definitely. Don't take it too seriously, but both the lead performers are fantastic.
What about Lady of the Pavements?
It's, again, a very silly plot. Lupi has a little more comedy in this one than she does in The Gaucho. The other leads, Jetta Goodall and William Boyd, don't come off as well. So Lupi kind of has to carry the film, which she does to some extent. She, again, plays a wild cabaret performer who is disguised as a duchess for bizarre plot reasons, which make no sense. And she gets to play around and be silly and have temper tantrums. And it's not as much fun as The Gaucho, but certainly it's worth seeing for Lupi.
So are many of these essentially typecasting for her?
She was typecast early on as the fiery young woman who can't control her temper. But she did a few films which were a lot more nuanced. Wolf Song, she played a wealthy young woman who falls in love with Gary Cooper, as who wouldn't? Where East is East, she plays a quieter character. In Resurrection, I think is her best English language dramatic film. She plays a Russian peasant who is done wrong by an army officer. And it's just such a remarkable dramatic performance. And that one you can see how if she'd had the proper handling and the proper voice training, she could have become a major, major star.
She is not the only Mexican actor in this period, right?
No.
There's Ramon Navarro and Dolores del Rio. As a group, what kinds of professional challenges did they face? I'm assuming racism is a big part of this discussion.
Yes.
In terms of their careers and their development.
Yes, Lupi and Dolores del Rio and Raymond Navarro all became big stars in the silent era. And they were able to avoid typecasting until the talkies came in. And they were huge stars, all three of them. And then when talkies came in, the accent problem happened and all three of their careers kind of spiraled. Lupi really hung on better than most of them. Raymond Navarro, his career was basically over by 1933-34 when he made a film with Lupi. Some of it was white gain as well. He aged very badly. And then he had a resurgence in the 1950s and 60s as a very dapper and handsome character actor. So his career had a happy ending, even if he didn't. And Dolores del Rio, she was typecast in a number of early talkies. And it wasn't until the mid-1940s when she returned to Mexico that she became a huge star over there and did a few character roles in the United States as well. So all three of them had problems when talkies came out, but their careers continued. They didn't wind up completely out of work.
Does Lupe become a big star in Mexico?
They had mixed feelings about her, just as Brazil had mixed feelings about Carmen Miranda, because they looked on her both as someone who was an insulting stereotype and someone who took off and went to the United States to make their money, whereas why don't you come back here and, you know, give us some work? So when Lupi returned to Mexico to make two films, La Zadunga and Nana, there was very mixed feelings about her. There were some protests. They were, well, where have you been so long? And why should we give you a special dressing room when we have Mexican actresses over here that could do just as well? So there definitely was, it's like when Marlene Dietrich went back to Germany in the early 60s, there were a lot of protests and very mixed feelings about her.
And how was she received when she went to Britain?
Oh, she was treated like a huge star. And as a matter of fact, she got better cinematography in her English films than she did in America because they took more time with them. And they were quota quickies, which were the American films that had to be made in Britain under their production system. But while they were B films, they were given an A production value. So she got great costumes, great cinematography in her British films. But British films just almost never did as well financially at the box office as American films did.
Did she wrestle with the same issues of racism?
Not really. She was
interesting.
Typecast in her British films, but not as much. And certainly in The Morals of Marcus, she just looks beautiful. And although the film itself isn't much, she was given a good role, good production values, and really shown off to great effect. So like some other stars, when their career flagged, they went to England and had great careers. Ben Lyon and Bebe Daniels turned out to be bigger stars in Britain than they were in America.
I didn't realize that.
Oh, they were huge stage, film, and television stars in England. And they stayed in London performing on stage during World War II and just became heroes over there.
Did Lupe have much experience on the stage and in Broadway?
Yes, she did. She starred in 3 Broadway shows, and she was a hit in all of them. The shows themselves, some did better, some did worse, but she got marvelous reviews, packed houses, and she was great on stage. She loved interacting with the audience and just having fun and improvising, which, of course, you can't do in the movies or on
exactly.
Radio. So she would do both musical comedy reviews and vaudeville and book shows on Broadway. And she would just cut off in the middle of what she was doing and start chatting with the audience and kidding around with them. And they would throw things back and forth at each other.
Wow.
She would see somebody who was at a previous show and yell, "What are you doing there taking up a seat? I saw you here already." So she just had a great time on stage and was very well received. She could have been a big stage star if she were handled and cast properly. But even the biggest stage stars, Ethel Merman and Carol Channing and Mary Martin, even they were lucky to get a hit every 5 or 10 years. The theater is not a place for a long-term career and steady work. Never has been, never will be.
Enormous amount of energy and versatility. It's almost unbelievable to me. She's extraordinary. We can't talk about Lupe Velez without talking about her personal life, right? Mm-hmm. And I did not know that she had been involved with Gary Cooper.
Oh, that was a huge romance at the time.
I had no idea.
With Joan Crawford and Doug Fairbanks Jr. were the hot couple in Hollywood in the late 20s, early 30s. And they were gorgeous. If you see the photos of them together, you think, oh, it's a crime against nature they never had a child, because they were just both young and hot and gorgeous and just at the beginning of their great fame, which means they were having a wonderful time suddenly being famous and being successful. So it was a big love for both of them. And it burned out in about 2 years. But for a while, they were the hottest couple in Hollywood.
So how did they meet and how did it burn out?
They met through work. They co-starred in The Wolf Song in 1929. And Gary had already heard about Lupe's reputation, both with men and in personality. So he was kind of a straight-laced Midwesterner. He was scared of her at first, but he had great fun with her. She loved sex. She had a very active sex life. But she was a bit much for him, and she was certainly too much for his parents. So he was kind of slowly backing into the shrubbery like Homer Simpson after a couple of years of her. And his parents really put an end to the relationship and while she was out of town, apparently, according to most stories, his parents came in and emptied all of his stuff out of her house and sent him off on a European vacation to get over her. And she was understandably furious about this, but she quickly went on to other relationships.
And who exactly were his parents that they would be quite so upset about this?
They were very wealthy, educated, and influential people. His father was a judge. His mother was, I believe, a teacher. And they did not see their Gary hooking up with a woman like this. I don't know whether it had to do with her being Mexican or whether it had to do with her just being Lupe Valenz, but they were bound and determined not to let him get married to her.
And what about Johnny Weissmuller?
I cannot figure that out for the life of me. It's such a strange relationship because he is not the typical guy that she would have gone with. She liked very well-educated, well-spoken, witty people. And he was kind of an agreeable schlub. I mean, he was not, he wasn't stupid, but he was not notably witty and intelligent. He was not particularly good looking, but they really had a lot of fun together at the beginning. They got along well together at the beginning, but things quickly went south and there was a lot of violence on both sides in that marriage. I'm amazed it lasted 5 years, although they filed for divorce about every week or two.
So it seemed. So is this a largely physical? Is this largely about sex, or is there really some other kind of connection?
It was about sex and companionship. They did have fun together out of bed as well, or they wouldn't have stayed together that long. He kidded her, she kidded him. They were good friends. They liked going out together, going to the fights. But it just was not meant to be. There was just too many variations in their personalities. So again, I'm amazed it lasted as long as it did.
How did Lupe spend her money? This is interesting to me.
Jewelry and furs. She always said that she never tried not to spend more than $5 on dresses because being a movie star, she said you wear it once and give it away. So why should I spend $200 on a dress when I can only wear it once, or the fans and photographers will start to complain? But she loved furs and she loved jewelry and she spent a fortune on those. She kept them locked in a safe in her bedroom. So she was smart with her money. She died wealthy and she had a nice house. It wasn't a big movie star mansion like Jane Mansfield's. It was a nice, small, two-story house in Beverly Hills, which is still standing. And close to the neighbors, not far from the street. So she eventually had to put up a wall. But she was smart with her money, other than the jewels and the furs, which were her extravagance.
She was a huge fan of boxing. She didn't bet on the fights?
I had the worst time writing about that because I am not a boxing fan and I knew nothing about boxing before starting this. So I had to do so much research on boxing and so much reading about fight fans as well. But apparently, the fights were very big in Hollywood in the 1930s and 40s, and a great many stars went there. Lupe and Mae West were two of the most enthusiastic, but James Cagney, the Marx Brothers, I mean, just everybody went. And yes, she loved the blood and the gore and the excitement and sitting in front, pounding her fist on the edge of the ring, shouting at the fighters and insulting the one she didn't want to win. And she just, she had a great time. She loved it.
I would think she'd be a bit of the entertainment herself in all of that.
I mean, you would think after a full day at the studio, she would be too tired. But again, she was always dialed up to 11. So even after a 10 or 12 hour work day, she was up to go to the fights and jump up and down and yell and scream.
Classic extrovert.
Oh, definitely. And she didn't drink except socially. And as far as I could find, she didn't take any recreational drugs. That was just her personality. She was just always on and always dialed up to 10.
So let's talk about the end of her life. As you noted at the beginning, right? She kills herself at the end. So how does she get to that place where suicide seems like a plan?
It took everybody by surprise. There were a lot of newspaper pieces that said that Lupe Velez is the last person you would expect to kill herself. But she had been having a hard time for a couple of years, both professionally and personally. And everything just piled up in those last 6 months. She found out she was pregnant and she was not married. And it's widely assumed that's the reason she killed herself. But she had many outs for that. She had three sisters, so she could have gone to Mexico to visit them, had the baby, and pawned the baby off as one of her sisters' babies. One of her sisters basically tried to extort her, which happened about a week before her death, and I think that hit her hard. The sister said, well, I'll pretend the baby is mine if you give me a whole lot of money and buy me a house, which nobody wants to hear. I mean, that sister does not come off well. Also, her business manager offered to put her up at one of his hotels and take the baby into an adoption agency like Loretta Young did. So the baby was definitely a problem, but not insurmountable. Now, her career was another problem because she had just gone to Mexico to make Nana. She made it in 1943. It was released in 44. And she was brilliant in it. Try to catch it online. It's available. And even though it's funny, in Mexican, when she's speaking Mexican, she has a more low-key acting style than she does in a lot of her American films. So this was going to be her big break. She was going to go back to Mexico and become a huge star over there. The studio was offering her La Boheme and Anna Karenina as well. And that fell through. Nana did not do as well as they were expecting. And the other two films were canceled. And she found herself back in Hollywood with no film offers, only a very bad Broadway show and a couple of vaudeville offers. And vaudeville was long dead by then. So her career was basically at a standstill. And socially, the guy who knocked her up didn't want to marry her. So it was just everything coming down on her at once. And even though she had money, she did not see a future for herself. So I totally understand why she did it.
So
I'm not going to second guess her on this.
Oh, no. Who is the man responsible for this?
Harold Raymond, also known as Harold Marisch, who was basically run out of Hollywood on a rail after this happened. He claimed that since his English wasn't great and her English wasn't great, it was all a misunderstanding. Of course, I would have married her. He was a good actor. I've seen some of his films. As a person, he was kind of a gigolo. He was extorted some money from an older woman in New York. And he was kind of a sketchy character, although he acted for another 20 years or so. So he was not somebody who would probably have married Lupe Velez if she hadn't gotten pregnant. And there is some dispute as to whether he was willing to marry her when she was pregnant and whether he demanded money for it or some kind of favor, which she was not in any position to give anyway. So it was just all hell coming loose at the same time for her in 1944.
That's a very tragic circumstance, isn't it?
It really is. It's just everything coming down at once, and it was just too much.
You mentioned the rumor that she drowned in the toilet.
Oh, my God. It's such a shame that Kenneth Anger, who wrote Hollywood Babylon, died after my book went to press, because I was longing to insult the hell out of him. So I had to be, since he was still alive and was the kind of person who would sue,
had to
be polite and ladylike and professional and not actually call him a lying sack of crap, which I wanted to do, because Hollywood Babylon is just full of lies and exaggerations and things he just made up off the top of his head. And one of the most infamous is Lupe Velez drowning in her toilet, which is not physically possible. I mean, try it sometime. You would have to have your maid holding you by the ankles and dunking you, you know?
So why do you think he came up with that particular lie? And why lie about her at all?
He lied about everybody. I mean, he's one of the, I mean, you name it, he lied. He said the Gish sisters were incestuous. Jane Mansfield was decapitated. Clara Bow slept with an entire football team. I mean, he was just a supreme fabricator.
It sells.
He did very well by it, too. His book was a major hit, and people still read it. And the stupider of these people still believe what's in there. Now, the toilet lie is, you have to admit, it's highly entertaining. It's a great story. It's a horrible, great story, but it's the sort of thing that people want to believe and people laugh at and make jokes about. And unfortunately, it's just become attached to her name.
So in the aftermath of her death, what happens to her estate and the jewels and the furs? And this
there
is
was a
interesting
huge fight. Yeah, her housekeeper and companion, Beulah Kinder, was left most of her estate. And Beulah really worked for her money. She was with Lupe for about 10 years. And she kept all the secrets. She never gave any tell-all interviews after Lupe died. And she held Lupe's very complex professional and social lives. So she was what they would call a personal assistant now. So she earned every penny of this. But her mother and her sisters and her brother just were furious when they found out that a non-relative was inheriting the bulk of Lupe's estate. So they fought it in court until almost nothing was left. I mean, the fight went on for about 10 years. And Beulah won. She wound up with most of the money at the end, although a good amount was left to her relatives. And as a matter of fact, one of her nephews gave an interview decades later saying that he and his siblings were sent to school on Lupe's money. So her family didn't come out of it broke by any means.
Not at all.
There was that awful estate sale.
Yes, that's what I was thinking about.
Yes, it was just a circus. They had starlets modeling her fur coats and her gowns and her jewelry in the front yard while people bid on it. And it was just such a circus atmosphere that some of the reporters who knew Lupe were just horrified that people seem to have forgotten, you know, she died a week ago. Stop yelling and cheering and whistling at the models and having a great old time.
Well, we're about out of time, Eve. So I want to thank you for a wonderful interview.
Oh, thank you. I had a great time talking about Lupe again.
She's an amazing character.
I only write about people I like and whose work I respect. So she was lots of fun to have as a roommate for a couple of years.
Well, she was lots of fun to read as well. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. You're welcome.